ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I just need to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Alan Kohler here with That's Business. And this week we're talking to Peter McCrory, the chief economist of Anthropic, the company that developed Claude AI, which is the fastest growing of the large language models. Now, we tried to get the Anthropic CEO, Dario Amodei, but we got Peter instead, which is fine because he is part of something called the Anthropic Institute, which is studying the impact of artificial intelligence on society more broadly, and also Claude in particular. And yes, he's got editorial independence from the company. We'll keep trying to interview Dario Amodei, and eventually we'll succeed, also other global leaders in AI. But Peter McCrory is a terrific start because his work is based on real data, both from Claude and from the economy. It's really about what's actually happening. Here's the chief economist of Anthropic, Peter McCrory, talking to us from San Francisco. Hello, Peter McCrory. Thanks for joining us on That's Business.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Peter McCrory, I think the first question has to be, what is your job exactly? Is it to make us all less worried about AI?
It's a great question. Not exactly. So I'm the head of economics, which basically means my team is trying to make sense of the economic implications of AI. We're a part of the Anthropic Institute, which is this new effort to produce substantive, rigorous, clear-eyed research about AI's impact on society, on the economy. And it's not intended to convince people to feel one way or another, but rather to be reflective and careful in how we make sense of how people and businesses are using Claude and what that might mean about the impact of AI today on the economy and also what might be on the horizon.
So your boss, Dario Amodei, published an essay in January on his personal website, not on Anthropic's website, in which he predicted that 50% of white-collar jobs would be taken by AI in 1 to 5 years, I think he said. He'd already said that a year ago as well. So is that just his opinion or was it based on work you've done?
So I would say that the bulk of the work that my team does is mostly trying to catch up to the present. So about a year ago, we introduced the Anthropic Economic Index, which is a measure of how people and businesses use Claude for specific tasks associated with jobs throughout the economy. And that was intended to just track usage and diffusion. Dario's comment is more about what's on the horizon, as you said, potentially in the next 1 to 5 years. Now,
do you agree with it though? Do you agree with what he said?
I would say that there is a range of uncertainty, and that's within one of the realms of possibility is this more disruptive scenario. AI is a general purpose technology. It is set to affect almost every occupation to some extent and every sector. And the capabilities are improving very rapidly. I would say so far in the data, we don't see signs that workers in roles that are most exposed to AI have had any material increase in the rates of unemployment. And we're putting out research that's intended to help us monitor how things develop so that we can have a real-time signal if that type of disruption ultimately materializes.
So just to be clear about it, the two things you're saying are that firstly, it's really difficult to say what's going to happen in 1 to 5 years. It's kind of really uncertain. But secondly, that you're not seeing any material change in employment in the jobs that are most affected by AI. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I would think about it in two steps. In one step is the question of nowcasting, which is what impact is AI having on the economy today and what's the right way to systematically track that over time. We put out a labor impact report in early March, where we introduce a monitoring framework to answer exactly that question. And to your point, we see no impact so far. The second question is a forecasting question. What might materialize in the next 1 to 5 years? And in this respect, there is a range of uncertainty. Is it like past technologies that automated some aspects of work, but nevertheless was skill biased in some way? So like enhancing expertise, maybe automating some jobs, but overall the unemployment rate remains subdued and there's a lot of churn under the surface? Or is it more like a technology that moves very quickly and produces concentrated increase in unemployment? I think we still don't have a good handle on how to assign probabilities to these different states of the world. And I think Dario's point, and I don't want to speak for him, this is that this is a scenario that we need to take seriously. Like, what should we be thinking about and doing today if that is a scenario that could possibly be on the horizon?
In journalism, we have something called editorial independence, you know, whereby the owner of the business doesn't tell us what to write. So do you have editorial independence in your team and in the Anthropic Institute generally?
So in general, I would say yes. The work that we produce is intended to stand on its own merits, to use the best methods that economists know how to use to answer the most pressing questions before us. And this is a question I think a lot about in building out my team and in building out the portfolio of our work. How do you establish credibility as a research group within Anthropic? One way that we do that is by publishing work out in the open. So we put out this labor impact report in early March, where we introduced a method for detecting displacement should it materialize. And part of the reason that we published that null finding was that it in some ways ties our hands to analyzing the data in a particular way that we think is sensible, that we can revisit over time and assess, is there any evidence yet of displacement or not? And, in the academic literature, there's all this worry about publications that are, you're doing analysis and you're only able to publish analyses that have a finding. One aspect of our work is we're able to publish work that doesn't have a finding, but can nevertheless lend some useful insight on this question.
What I find striking is that your work and your words, what you're saying now, is much more sober than your boss, Dario Amodei, who's kind of says stuff like that, that 50% of white collar jobs are going to go in 1 to 5 years. He also said that there's a 25% one in four chance of doom, some sort of existential problem for humanity. I mean, these are kind of wild statements. What's going on here? I mean, that's not what you'd expect the CEO of a company that's got a product that they're trying to sell to go around saying.
So I think here that we should be a bit circumspect about the range of uncertainty before us. This is the most consequential technology of the last 100 years. It's a general purpose technology. Every sector, almost every occupation, as I've mentioned, is set to be affected. Adoption has been very fast. The models themselves are improving very quickly. At present, the most performant model can handle roughly 14 hours of autonomous work reliably. And the time horizon that these models can handle is doubling roughly every 4 to 7 months. That alone would raise questions about how this sort of broad-based automation of cognitive work might very well affect large swaths of the labor market. You add to the fact that it may very well represent an innovation in the method of innovation. So macroeconomists talk about the importance of innovation for producing long-run growth. What AI represents is this possibility of loosening the bottlenecks to the innovation process. And if you put that into your standard long-run economic growth model, it can produce an even larger disruptive force.
I mean, that's really interesting. And I want to get onto the innovation of innovation in a minute. But what you seem to be saying is that a lot of our sort of assumptions about economics and our models rely on linear progression, not exponential. I mean, doubling every 4 to 7 months is, it's exponential, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of much faster than Moore's law, which was the transistor and computer doubling every 18 months to 2 years. I mean, that's kind of been going on for decades.
Yeah.
But now we've got AI doubling every 4 to 7 months. I mean, there's no way, is there, that economic modelings or predictions can actually cope with that?
So I'll try to ground this a little bit based on some of the research that my team put out in late November. So we wanted to get a handle on this question of what AI might mean for overall productivity within the economy. And so we did this exercise where we asked Claude to evaluate how much time savings did people get when they used Claude for the particular task that they're doing.
You asked Claude to do it. You didn't do it. So Claude did it.
So, well, that's a part of our privacy-preserving approach, is we use Claude to evaluate the conversations so that no human is actually looking at the content. So, you know, like for compiling information from reports, that's something that large language models can do very fast. Maybe a time savings on the order of 90%. Checking diagnostic images is something that skilled professionals can do very quickly. A radiologist can look at a diagnostic image and evaluate what's going on. And indeed, we see limited efficiency gains. Then we use standard macro techniques to add up all of the efficiency gains that we see on our platform. And we propose this question: what if it takes 10 years for those efficiency gains to spread throughout the economy? And the number that you get is an increase in labor productivity growth of around 1.8 percentage points each year over the next decade. Now, that's a very large number in the context of labor productivity growth for advanced economies, which over the last 20 years have experienced sort of this productivity slowdown. It would roughly bring us back to something like the late 90s and early 2000s. Now, to your point about the fact that these models are getting better, one reason to think that this is an underestimate is it is current usage of current generation models. As businesses figure out how to adopt these tools much more scalably and efficiently for a wider range of tasks in the economy, that would push the number up. And for roles that are more at risk of automation, I think there's a greater risk of displacement. Add to that, the models themselves are just getting better. And so that's like one way to, this is a very large number, and there are reasons to think that it could very well be much larger in the future.
So Anthropic has just announced that revenue has doubled between the first and second quarters, and the Wall Street Journal said you're about to report the first profit. So what does that tell us about what's going on with the take-up of AI? Because we've also seen data from OpenAI going on, and there's tons of stuff coming out now about the money that's being made from AI.
So I would say that it's generally consistent with this point that I like to make, that adoption of AI has been much faster than previous technologies, consequential technologies like the rollout of the internet or the personal computer. Hitting rates of adoption in 2 years that it took those technologies 5 years, and certainly much faster than the rollout of electricity, which required a build-out of the infrastructure. Now, we see other evidence of very fast adoption in the Anthropic Economic Index. So we look at differences in adoption rates across U.S. states. And what we see is that states that are late adopters, so there's like low overall usage, they're actually catching up much faster to early adopting places like New York and California, about 5 to 10 times faster than that diffusion process typically takes. That's based on a reference to some academic work that was published last year. So like, I think this is internally, an internally coherent story, that not only is it a broadly applicable technology, but people and businesses are very quickly finding immense value out of using these tools.
So does your work reveal that this adoption is real, that there's no smoke and mirrors going on, no marketing by LLMs and AI companies, particularly the agentic companies, where they're talking it up beyond the reality of the use of it? Is there some sort of distinction between those things going on?
So I don't have much of a perspective on the marketing angle, but what I can tell you is what we see in the data that we produce.
Yeah.
So one way to get a handle on this is, a year ago, about a third of all jobs in the taxonomy that we look at, the ONET taxonomy, a third of those jobs had a quarter of the tasks associated with those jobs. So like what computer programmers do, what marketers do. A third of those jobs had a quarter of the tasks showing up in our data, things that Claude was doing. Over just the course of a year, that number, a third of all jobs, rose to about 50%. This points in the direction of a broadening out of adoption that is consistent not just with overall uptake, but increasingly useful adoption in a wider range of activities and tasks. And we see a similar pattern at the individual level. So people who've been using Claude for more than 6 months are more likely to take on a wider array of activities. You're more likely to use Claude for personal tasks. I use Claude to help me make meals at home sometimes, as an example. And this is, just in general, I think a reflection of the fact that it's a broadly applicable technology and very easy to use.
Yeah, because there's two streams, or it seems to be at least these two broad streams of use of AI. One is by individuals sitting at their desk at home or whatever on their phones or something, just asking questions and possibly developing relationships. I mean, Richard Dawkins said he spent two or three days with Claude and found it become his friend, and he concluded that maybe this thing is conscious, right? On the other hand, there's the use of AI in AI agents by companies that are doing tasks, right? And they're very specific. They're not friends or anything. They're just doing tasks, right? So talk us through this difference in the streams. How do you think that's going to develop?
Yeah, so I guess there are like two different ways that I could take this question. One is the first one that I'll just mention is that we did do this exercise of breaking down usage by, is it personal use? Is it professional? So in the workplace, or is it coursework? Students and educators use Claude to learn and to develop course curriculum. Interestingly, patterns of usage across these three categories vary across countries. High-income countries, which tend to have high rates of adoption of Claude, are much more likely to use Claude for personal use cases and less likely to use it for educational purposes. I think this is consistent with a learning curve or an adoption curve, that the longer that you've been using this technology, you begin to experiment with new ways to use it, including in the personal domain. Now, on the business adoption side of things, I think this is an incredibly important question for thinking about what impact will it have on the economy.
And productivity
and the labor market. It's not just capabilities, it's capabilities plus what determines firm adoption and what is the consequence of that firm adoption. So in that respect, we looked at some of our API traffic. How are businesses embedding Claude capabilities to automate existing or new workflows? And one of the things that we find is that for the most complex tasks that businesses bring to Claude, you can think here like automated biological research or automating some sophisticated machine learning model to predict weather patterns. When businesses use Claude in this very sophisticated way, they rely on disproportionately more input context than for simple tasks. Now, why is that interesting? I think it's interesting because it points toward the source of tasks we don't see in our data. Tasks that the model might be very good at, but the context information is not readily available. So concretely, if you're a large, complex organization.
I don't think so I can just interrupt. I don't think I understand what you mean by context information. I mean, are you talking about just the amount of tokens, AI tokens that are being used?
The amount of tokens, the input tokens. Yeah, exactly. Right. So you need to provide.
And that means it's more expensive to use.
That's actually an interesting and subtle point here is that, like, by looking at enterprise adoption, businesses are incentivized to do this in the most efficient way. And so the correlation that we trace out between output complexity and input tokens likely captures some fundamental constraint on what is needed by businesses to tackle very hard problems. And so I think this points in the direction of a standard lesson of new technologies, which is businesses need to make complementary investments to unlock the benefits of new technologies. This might be data modernization, getting information from different siloed data ecosystems within your company, or maybe like new organizational processes. If your coworker has information that the model needs to develop a sales strategy, not on their computer, but in their mind, businesses need to figure out how do you elicit that information in a way that helps the model complete the task. And so I think this is one reason why we're still in the early stages of the impact of AI on the economy. This problem of how do you actually embed and deploy a very proficient AI system is very challenging to sort out in practice.
You said before that it's different to electricity because with the adoption of electricity, they had to build power stations and all this and power lines and everything, which was a lot of infrastructure. But I would have thought it's actually a pretty good analogy because in order to make AI work, you've got to build all these data centers and you need a lot of power. So to what extent is AI adoption and production being limited by the amount of compute that is available in data centers and the amount of power that's available to do it?
It's a great question. And sort of these input market or input factors are certainly really important in making compute available for both training new generations of models and supplying that compute. But I guess the general point that I was making is conditional on that compute being available, you just need access to a digital infrastructure. Like access to the internet is all you need in order to access the model capabilities. And so I think the analog to electricity would be there's electricity generation, which relied similarly on input factors. And then there's the infrastructure to provision that electricity throughout the economy. The infrastructure needed to provision electricity had to be built out. And there's a large literature on like what happened and how long it took and how it shaped regional economic development in the US and around the world. With AI, you do need to figure out how to sort of generate the model capabilities and serve the model, making that compute available to customers. But if that's available, you only need access to the internet to get frontier capabilities. And I think another piece of the puzzle here is it's not just the infrastructure. Oftentimes, new technologies rely on skilled expertise in knowing how to use the tools. With large language models, you can just speak to them like you would speak to a coworker. And that barrier to entry is much lower, might also help to explain why adoption has been much faster.
You did some work with Maxim Massenkoff, and you introduced an idea of you called observed exposure, which is the gap between what AI can do in theory and what Claude is actually being used for. So what surprised you about that and how long will it take for that gap to be closed?
Yeah, so this is the labor impact report that I was alluding to before. I think the motivation here was trying to figure out how do the capabilities that we see in all of the benchmarks and that we're tracking very closely over time, how do those model capabilities meet the real world? As we've just mentioned, there are reasons why it's easier or harder to adopt AI in profession A versus profession B. Software engineers are much more likely to use Claude than other knowledge workers, for example. Our motivation in producing the observed exposure measure was, where is Claude being used in automated ways for work purposes? Because that type of adoption is likely to signal displacement, or at least has the greatest chance of predicting displacement.
Why is that?
So if in our analysis, we classify usage between automated use, so you give a simple directive to Claude and Claude completes it, or augmented use, where you go back and forth. You work with Claude more like a thought partner. If you're using Claude more as a thought partner, that clearly points in the direction of labor augmentation. That tends to be a source of pushing up demand for labor and expertise.
Right.
Whereas if Claude is able to complete the task end to end in a fully autonomous and reliable way, you can think about data entry work where you're grabbing bits of information from documents and compiling it into a different database.
Right.
Increasingly, large language models can just do that task, maybe even better than humans. We would expect that those are the jobs where demand for those workers is likely to subside as businesses ultimately adopt. Interestingly, we do see that occupations that have high AI exposure, computer programmers, data entry workers, as I mentioned, these jobs are also expected by the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the US to have weaker job growth over the next decade. So it does seem like we're picking up some structural dimension of where the economy is headed. And we think that this notion can help us track whether there's any widespread displacement today.
But that 1.8% productivity growth over 10 years that you talked about before,
yep.
To what extent is that to do with augmentation and to what extent is it displacement? I mean, obviously, if there's fewer workers doing the same thing, then productivity, labor productivity of the workers increases, right? So did you kind of distinguish between those two things in thinking about the productivity growth?
Yeah, so the way that I would think about this is the 1.8 percentage point number that we talked about relies on this thing called Holton's theorem, which is a sort of standard way to add up efficiency gains without making too many assumptions about how those efficiency gains emerge. In general, it's being able to do a particular task faster. And given the structure of the economy today, what would that mean overall if you add up those efficiency gains? We ran this survey of Claude users recently where we asked them about their fears and hopes with AI. And one of the things that emerged in that survey was a lot of discussion around the labor market impact and also the productivity gains that people are experiencing. More so than being able to do things faster, people were more often likely to indicate that Claude helps them do more. So broadening of scope. That broadening of scope looks more like labor augmentation than labor automation. And in that sense, I think that that might be an important aspect of the productivity gains that we ultimately might experience.
Just finally, I want to talk about Australia. Late last month, Anthropic held a briefing with 170 representatives from Australian finance, communications, transport, energy, data, and a whole lot of sectors. Is the goal of the business to become as integrated with all elements of society as possible, do you think? Is that how you're approaching it?
I guess, you know, this goes back to this point that the technology is broadly applicable, and we also want to be good stewards of the technology, or at least I think that that's like part of the goal. The thing that motivates me in our research is we're not just putting data and research out there because it's interesting. We're doing it because the impact on society and on the economy will be shaped by the decisions that we make as much by the technological capabilities themselves. And so in that sense, it's wise to have conversations with all stakeholders who might be affected by the technology so that we can steward our role responsibly.
Yeah, fair enough. Are you able to talk to us a bit about Mythos? I mean, this is a sort of an extra Claude project or part of an extension of Claude that was kind of released but not released or withdrawn because of its dangers in hacking. What I'm interested in is whether, to what extent that kind of tells us where we're heading here. I mean, it seems to have been such a dramatic improvement in Claude's capability that it's able to both do and withstand any amount of hacking. Is that right? I mean, how should we think about this?
I think the way that I think about Mythos is that it is, you know, the thing that make Claude very good at helping me very quickly do sophisticated statistical analysis and econometric analysis for my purposes, or help me build interactive dashboards quite quickly. That's the same capability that allows the model to identify vulnerabilities in critical infrastructure and software systems. And as we talked about before, these models are doubling roughly every 4 to 7 months in terms of one notion of their capabilities. And so in that sense, it's just consistent with this exponential that we've been on. That said, this represented a substantial step up in the model's cybersecurity, and particularly its sort of attack capabilities, and which is why we took the approach that we took, which is not to release it more broadly, to try to partner with important organizations to figure out how do we harden the critical infrastructure that might otherwise be affected by our model. Now, the reality is that this might be Claude. Other models are catching up very quickly. So while Mythos is Anthropic's model, there are other models that in some time could also catch up. And so we need to be judicious with how we approach things.
In releasing it to certain organizations, should those organizations be friendly countries like Australia? I mean, the chief lawyer of Anthropic apparently flew to Australia recently for closed door negotiations with the Australian government. You probably don't know what he was talking about, but is it possible that involves, you know, releasing or giving governments like Australia access to Mythos?
So I don't know much about what those conversations were, so I can't really comment there.
Fair enough. Well, thanks for being part of That's Business, Peter.
Thanks for having me. It was a delight.
Thanks so much for joining me on That's Business. You can find That's Business on the ABC Business Daily feed every Friday. And so you don't miss out, make sure you follow ABC Business Daily to find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And please tell your friends about us. Carrington Clark and the ABC Business Daily team will be back in the feed on Monday.